Really. Now be careful to make sure, double check your mobile phone is turned off. Because if your mobile phone goes on during the talk or the meditation, that's bad karma for your mobile phone. In its next life, you'll probably be reborn as a parking meter. Which is very important karma. So please turn off the mobile phones. And in this meditation, more importantly, turn off your mobile minds. Keep them still and peaceful. That's the reason why we're here. Not to have more contact with our friends, which is endless. And if you turn your mobile phone off, they will not miss you. It won't be the end of the world. You will be free from all those distractions. In fact, it'll make you more interesting. Everybody's got mobile phones these days. Not me. I don't have a mobile phone. That makes me happy. So if you want to be happy like me, throw away your mind. But I'm not talking about mobile phones today. I want to carry on to talk about how to meditate. Remember yesterday I said meditation is all about being still. And when you're still, you have lots of happiness and love. You also have insight. They all go together. You cannot separate them. But please know, insight isn't thinking. I'm just talking. I just gave a talk down in the refectory downstairs. But thinking, we always have the idea that we can think ourselves to truth. Which is one of the reasons why we can sit around having a cup of coffee, arguing over non-self, the nature of enlightenment, the nature of being. We don't understand a thing. Philosophers have been trying to do this for centuries. And they've never got anywhere. The thinking is the wrong tool to use. It never gets deep. Even in English, we say we think around the subject. Just like the moon goes around the earth but never actually lands on the thing. We think about things, we never see into them. And one of the problems with thinking, it's all about names and concepts, which are old stuff. You have to get much deeper than that. As a scientist in Cambridge, I was saying this earlier, one of the great lessons I learned was from quantum physics, where some of the stuff which comes up from quantum physics just really challenged me. It didn't make sense. My thinking could never actually comprehend it. For a good example of that is the great Schrodinger's cat experiment. And the Schrodinger's cat experiment goes like this. Erwin Schrodinger was this great quantum physicist. And he said, if you put a cat into a sealed box with a cyanide couch, he's not a very good Buddhist. You put a cat in a sealed box with a cyanide capsule, and that capsule will be broken according to a quantum process like the decay of the season matter, which people use for timing their crops. And there's a 50-50 chance the season atom, so the file will be broken. 50% it will, 50% it won't. It's a quantum process. So it says, until you actually open the box, is the cat alive or is the cat dead? And the truth of the matter is, according to quantum physics, it's absolutely accurate, the cat is in a third state. It's neither alive nor dead. Now you would always say, that's impossible. The cat's either alive or dead. Ask the cat will know. That's not the point. The truth of the matter is, you're not extending your conceptual framework. Your imagination is too limited. Schrodinger's experiment was actually true. That cat is in a third state. So it is extending the way you look at things. The trouble with thought is it's so limited and so narrow. If you think about that, what I've just said is nonsense. If you ask any quantum physicist, that's standard Copenhagen interpretation of quantum theory. That's true. Weird goes way beyond your concepts, but it is true. That's why you can never think yourself to truth. And all your thinking will never get you answers. It will just give you arguments instead. All the great religions of our world, you always think. We write those thoughts in books, and then we take the books and hit each other over the head with our holy books. The Abhidhamma is right, bang, bang, bang. No, no. The Bible is right, bang, bang, bang. No. The Quran is right. Always hitting ourselves over the head with books. Shh. And calm those thoughts down. And there's a good chance you might see the truth. Even in life, how many times have you tried to remember a person's name? The more you think about it, the less likely it is you remember. You stop thinking, and the name just comes up. Of course, that's an obvious example which we use. But why don't we do that more often in life? Stop thinking, and know. Because the thinking is unmovable to the mind, which stops you seeing things truly. It is the waves on the lake which distort the image of the stars and the moon above. It doesn't give you truth. If you want to find insight, reality, for goodness sake, stop thinking. Stop arguing. Stop trying to contemplate Anicca Dukkha Anatta or the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination. All those things you think. But you're still not a soul on you. Why? Because the thinking doesn't go deep enough. Which is why someone like the Buddha sat under a Bodhi tree and said, only the stillness of the jhanas, that's the only way you can see things as they truly are. Not the thinking, but when the thinking stops. So, how do we do that? It's very simple. Don't do anything. Stop trying. Stop trying to get somewhere. When I first went to my master, Ajahn Chah, he kept on saying, you come here not to attain something, but you come here to let go of things. So if you come on this meditation retreat trying to get something out of this, trying to attain something, you're going in the wrong direction. If you come here to let go of things, to abandon things, to lose things, great, you're in the right place. So see how much you can lose, not how much you can gain. And any of you Sri Lankans who are just desperate to get someone before you die, that's the first stage of enlightenment, you will never get it with that type of attitude. Just see how much you can abandon and let go. See how much you can lose. The more you lose, the closer you are to enlightenment. That's why I said yesterday, it's in the beginning, the introduction of that book which I wrote, The Art of Disappearing. The closer to enlightenment you are, the more of a loser you are. So when people come up to me and say, you Buddhist monks are all losers. Yes, you've understood. Amazing. And the biggest loser, do you have that TV show? Who's the biggest loser? The wonderful fellow behind me. The Buddha was the original biggest loser. Not everybody. So that's why sometimes people just ask me, how should you address a monk? So you know, you call me loser. Or even better, you know, if you want to be more formal, your emptiness. So don't call me your reverence or your holiness. Holiness is much better because a hole is always empty. The hole is your emptiness because that's what we're doing. So understanding this gives you an idea of why we meditate. To lose things, not to gain things. And the simile I wanted to give today is one of my favorite similes, which tells you not just how to meditate, but what happens when you meditate, and how so simple it is. And again, this is not Vipassana, it's not Samatha, it's not Metta, it's not Zen meditation, it's not Mahamudra meditation, it is just meditation. There isn't two ways, three ways or four ways. Meditation is just meditation. So, this simile is the thousand petal lotus simile. And this comes because a lotus is a symbol of Buddhism. You probably have lotuses down here somewhere. The Buddha is supposed to be sitting on a lotus. It's such a famous simile of Buddhism that we have even in Vajrayana the phrase Om Mani Padme Hum, which is Sanskrit Pali. It's the same. All it means is the Om and the Hum at the end. It's like Namo in Pali. Just like homage, worship. And the two important words are Mani Padme, means a jewel in the heart of the lotus. So say worship, praise the jewel in the heart of the lotus. That's what the words mean. But what is it pointing to? It points to a way of meditation which is opening the thousand petal lotus to see the jewel right in the middle of it. What does that simply mean? You are that lotus. You want to find what's right in the center of you. What is this jewel in the heart of the lotus? Who you are. What you are. What drives you? What loves you? Who's listening to all of this? Find out what is this. This jewel in the heart of this lotus. There's a great simile because it accurately describes the heart of meditation, the stages of meditation, and more importantly, how it works. Because that's what people want to know. What do I have to do? How do I do this? How do I meditate? So, back to the lotus. The lotus is closed at night time. It's just like this spot. And when the first rays of the sun appear in the morning, the light and heat from that sun starts to warm the outermost petal of the lotus, which is very rough because it has to endure the wind and the dust. It has no fragrance at all and very coarse. You see a lotus when it's closed up, the outermost leaf has got no fragrance at all. But when the heat and light from the sun starts to open up that lotus, the first petals open up to reveal the next set of petals inside, which are much more refined, have some fragrance, and are more beautiful. So the light and heat of the sun can fall on that next layer of petals. When they warm up, they begin to open too, to reveal the next layer of petals, allowing that to receive the warmth and light of the sun, so that can open up as well. Stage by stage, level by level, the outer coverings open up to reveal what's inside. And the deeper you go into that lotus, the more beautiful are the leaves, or the petals rather. The scent is more rich and delightful, and even the thickness of those petals is more and more gossamer, more refined, the deeper you go in. And that is how we meditate. The heat and light from the sun represents your awareness and your kindness. The two are necessary to open you up. Mindfulness without kindness will get you very hardly anywhere. Compassion without mindfulness doesn't get you very far. You put those two together, you're aware and you're kind. You find you go in. You open out. For example, when you start meditating, you sit on a cushion or on a chair or on a bench. Yeah, you're aware of your body, but are you kind to it? If you're not kind to the body, and you say, I'm just going to endure, you'll find the body will not open up to reveal what's inside. All you'll be able to be aware of is the aches and the pains in the body. And you can spend a whole meditation period just being with those aches and pains, and it'll get beyond your body. So that's why you have to sit comfortably. You have to be kind to your body. So when I meditate, I close my eyes, I look at my body, and if there's any feeling that my knees aren't comfortable, I don't just say, I'll just enjoy, 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 enjoy. This is not the way of pain. You know the breath meditation? You know in part of what the breath meditation is called? Anapana Sati. Anna means along with, pana means the breath, sati means mindfulness. Along with the breath, mindfulness. That's anapanasati. The Buddha never ever taught anapanasati, which means mindfulness along with the pain. That's not the Buddha's teachings. In fact, that's the very first thing the Buddha said once he became enlightened. Middle way, don't do that. If it's hurting, if it's painful, it's tiring the body, it's wearing it out, that is Atthaginamatana Yoga. Don't do that! And how many people say, no, I'm going to fight the pain. I'm going to work through the pain. I'm going to understand the pain. That is not the Buddha's teachings. If you do that, working through the pain, you either end up in hospital by one of the monks I knew. This monk had aches in his knees. He said, I'm just going to endure this. I'm just going to fight the pain. I'm just going to investigate it, let it be. He had to have double knee reconstruction. That's stupid. If you have pain, see if you can alleviate it. And why? Compassion. Kindness. If you can't be kind to your body, your own body, who can you be kind to? So be kind to your body. And then, if you're kind to your body, it relaxes. Well, I always remember, because I grew up in London, poor family, spent a lot of my time playing soccer in the streets. And if you play soccer and go for a tackle, so often you scrape the skin off your knees. I always had scabs on my knees. They're just part of growing up. I know a friend who actually grew up he wrote this book, he grew up in the port city of Sydney called Balmain. And he also had a rough childhood. He said, in that city, the port city of Sydney, if you still had your front teeth by the time you were four, it meant you were a girl. Everybody had fights, even four was such a rough area. Me, I never had fights. We played football, we went for tackles, always scraping the skin off my knee. And what would I do? I'd run to my mummy. My mummy would kneel down and kiss it. She called it kissing it better. Immediately after she did that, all the pain left, I was back playing soccer again. Never once did that wound get infected. Why? Because my mother had just put a mouthful of germs on an open wound. So the kindness was more important. The kindness heals, gets rid of pain, relaxes, and gives you very, very good health. A couple of doctors here will be interested in some of the stories, but I love telling the last time I was really sick, and it's just an acute sickness, not anything chronic, it was about 2 years ago, when somebody gave us some food, which was obviously something wrong with it, and I got food poisoning. Quite a few other mice got food poisoning, but I got it very bad. If you've ever had food poisoning, you know what it's like, you get cramps in the stomach and it really hurts. It was only then in the past about 10 years when I've deliberately given up food, because people actually come to feed me. I consider my tummy to be a field of merit for you. I don't really own it. It's yours to put in whatever you think is appropriate. If I don't own my stomach, you do. So anyway, so it's an occupational hazard for a monk. Sooner or later someone is going to give you some food which is going to make you sick. So I had this terrible, terrible food poisoning. If I was sensible, I should have called a doctor and gone to hospital for the day or 2 days. But instead, I was in my cave where I live, rolling around the floor, not being able to sit still. Holding my tummy was very agonizing. Until I remembered, as young Brahmi, being a hypocrite, what would I tell other people to do? And it's very hard, it's easy to teach others, but to teach yourself, you've got to keep remembering. And I said, well, I'll teach them just to be mindful and be kind. Well, you open up a lotus. So that's what I did. It only took 20 minutes, that's all. And the pain was totally gone. I was up and about, no more food poisoning. I don't know what happened to the bacteria or the poison. I haven't got a clue, but certainly I felt great, and that was the end of it. Because what you did, you were aware of the pain, which was almost unendurable. But you kept your awareness there and gave this beautiful compassion and kindness. Because when you're kind to a pain, it relaxes slightly. The mindfulness told me it was relaxing. The mindfulness gave me feedback. So I carried on being a little bit more kind. And the pain got a little bit less. A little bit more kind. The mindfulness was giving me feedback throughout, showing that I was going in the correct direction. And soon that kindness and the mindfulness together meant there was no pain left at all. Totally vanished. That's exactly what I mean, and I've told quite a few of you already about the monster who came into the Emperor's palace. That was my monster, food poisoning. That was my palace, a monk's stomach. Very important. And this pain came in, I just gave it kindness and mindfulness. It totally vanished away. Just like my mother could kiss a wound better. Just like doctors with compassion, it's amazing, it's what you can cure. It's a very powerful force. How it works, why it works, I'm not sure, but my goodness it does. So whenever I have a pain in my body, I give it kindness. And I just watch it relax, and relax, and relax. Until the body gets so loose, so comfortable. It is like, as I said yesterday, you first wake up in the morning, in a warm, cozy bed. You're so comfortable, you don't want to get out. That's the comfort of the body when you start meditating. Mindfulness and kindness is to relax the whole body, which means you can let it go and go inside. The body opened up and you go to the next layer of petals. That next layer of petals is your mental world. And of course, how can you calm your mental world when the body is not relaxed yet? The body will first of all take precedence. So you have to be kind to your body, which is why, please, sit on a chair if you need one. Don't think that, no, that's only for namby-pamby cream puffs. Real meditators sit on the floor. If you think that's you, get your cushions away. I'll get some nails or broken glass. You can try sitting on that. That is not the way of Buddhism. So be kind to your body, and it disappears. Then you get your mental world, the next layer of petals. So what should you do? Be mindful, be kind to this mental world. Don't try and control it. Give this beautiful compassion, acceptance. The way I describe kindness is to open the door of your heart to this moment, no matter what it is, with unconditional mindfulness. Not mindfulness which wants to be mindful of one thing and not another. Not mindfulness which chooses, but the unconditional, loving mindfulness which can respect anything, no matter what you're experiencing. My example of that, one of the worst, no one called it worst, the most stupid times in my monastic life. So I've been a monk for 6 years. I found this monastery which was absolutely perfect. My ideal monastery in the north of Thailand. Now remember, I was born in England. I'm an English monk. So I like my tea. It was actually, because I like tea so much, when I first heard of a monk called Ajahn Chah, I thought anyone whose name means tea must be a good teacher to lose. And then I went off to this monastery in the north of Thailand, which was in the middle of a tea plantation. I thought, this is heaven. They had a beautiful cave there. It was abandoned, so no one to talk to, just me. Oh, there was a traffic problem in this monastery. The traffic problem was one car a week would come up and go down again. You had to be looking in the right direction at the right time to see the traffic problem. It was wonderful, it was so silent, so peaceful. Nothing to do but meditate all day. You know, the people there, they weren't interested in keeping precepts. They weren't interested in meditation or Buddhism. All they wanted to do was feed me. And I thought, yes, good deal, okay. You can leave me alone for a change. They were so happy to feed me and get rid of me because they had their things to do. And I was so happy to get rid of them. So I had all day and night to meditate, which first couple of weeks it went really well. And then I started thinking and getting restless. And I tried to stop my thoughts. And they just got worse. I tried to control my mind. It really started going out of hand. I started thinking what I called unmonkish thoughts. I started thinking about my old girlfriends. I wonder where she is. I wonder if she's still single. No, I'm a monk. I don't think about it. Stop it. And started thinking of sexual fantasies and romance. All the things a monk is not supposed to think about. So I stopped it. Come on, watch your breath. But the more I tried to stop all those thoughts, the more they came in. Have you ever tried to control your mind like that? Sometimes it drives you crazy. And it was driving me crazy. I couldn't stop these thoughts coming in, even though I was a very committed monk. I've left all that behind. Why do you keep coming in? So I got so desperate that one morning, there's no one to talk to, no teacher, because it's far too remote for anything. So there was a big Buddha statue in the main hall, like the one behind me. And even though I'm not a superstitious monk, the retro physicist from Cambridge University, you can't get more in your head than that. But just out of desperation, I bowed to the Buddha and prayed for help. And a thought came into my mind. The thought was to do a deal. That's what Westerners do in our culture. Chinese too, we do deals. So the deal was that my mind will watch my breath for most of the day, but from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every afternoon, I would give my mind permission to think whatever it wanted, given the weirdest sexual fantasy, thoughts about girls, romance, anything. I would not stop, I would permit anything, even the things I'd be most embarrassed to tell anyone about. I could do that from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every afternoon. The rest of the day I'd behave. I thought that was a fair deal. If you want to play around, 3 to 4 p.m. is playtime, the rest of the day you behave. So, it didn't quite work out the way I expected, because I was still as restless as ever. Every time I was watching the breath, it was like these thoughts were just kicked down the mind and just burst in, and I had all these thoughts in my mind. I'd chase them out, watch the breath, and they come back again. If you ever try that, it's so tired, it wears you out. So when it got to 3 p.m, I was really tired. I went out to the hut where I lived, leant against the wall, put my feet up, so I was really tired. I said, okay, now, you can think whatever you want from now on, from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. And now, any fantasy, the weirdest, kinkiest stuff, I wouldn't try and stop. And for the next hour, my mind watched every breath without missing one. It was just so easy. That's a true story. And that taught me an important lesson. Where those thoughts came from was me trying to control my mind. When I let the mind be, it didn't need to think anymore. I was controlling my mind. That's where the thoughts came from. If you know how to let things go, let things be. Just be aware and be kind. The mind becomes so still, all the thoughts vanish. What's happening is you're being kind and mindful, and you go into the next layer of petals in the mental world, it opens up into the center of time. It's like the past and the future, all these outermost petals which dominate your mental world. You don't try and stop them. Just be kind, be aware. Be this beautiful compassion. Whatever happens, past or future, is fine. I'm just going to let it be with kindness. And you find that it disappears. The mindfulness and kindness opens the petals of the lotus. So you go inside. And in the center of time, it's called the present moment. You don't try and be in the present moment. Your job as meditators is to be aware and be kind. In the same way it relaxes your body, it relaxes your mind, you come into the present moment. If you try and make yourself come into the present moment, you find it's too tense, you can't stay there. If you allow the natural process of opening the lotus to happen, it just occurs automatically. When you come into the present moment, it's beautiful. So what do you do next? There's no next, it's only now. If ever you have that thought in meditation, I've got to this place, what do I do next? A red flag should come up. The alarm bell should ring. There is no next. There's only now. You've lost the plot. You're not meditating anymore. So you're just being now. So what should I do? Just be kind, be mindful. And if you're just kind and mindfulness to this present moment, you'll find just like that lotus, those petals open up to reveal what's inside. You know what's inside the present moment? Silence. It's beautiful silence where there's no more thinking. Just knowing. Just being. That is so wonderful. I give another simile. This is one of my insight similes, which I haven't said yesterday. And it's a simile, I've used this simile for so many stages of meditation, even for the highest insights. It's a simile of the tadpole and the frog. Once upon a time, there was a little tadpole who was born in the water. And little tadpole, she went to school, and she was very intelligent. So after going to school in the lake, then she went to university, but she was also very interested in religion. So she came to the Buddhist temple in the lake, and she learned all the Abhidhamma and Pali. And so whenever she heard about water, not only did she know what water was in chemistry class, she even knew from Abhidhamma class what water was. At least so she thought. But how can a tadpole ever know what water is? When you're born in water, lived all your life in water, and know nothing else but water. You can know its chemical composition. You can know the physics of the atoms which make up water. You can know the Abhidhamma regarding water. But that's all thoughts. Can you ever really understand water? That has been around you all the time. But one day, little frog, also little tadpole, grows little things on her shoulders and on her bottom. They're her legs and arms. And soon little tadpole has become a frog. And one day, just for fun, she jumps out of the lake, and for the first time in her life, something is missing. Something which has always been there for however long she can remember is now gone. Water. She's now standing on dry land. Ah, now I know what they meant by water. The thing which is now gone. Do you know what time is? What it means? You can philosophize about time. You can think about time. You can actually do equations about time. But how can you ever know what time is when you've lived in time all your life? But when you just get to the place of present moment, when time disappears. Then you've got a chance to understand what time really means. Only when they vanish can you get insight. Thinking, that big bug to every meditation. Just like we're talking about mosquitoes on the car here. You know, they asked for the many mosquitoes in those monasteries in Thailand. There are thousands of those mosquitoes. And there was such a danger to monks because, look, you know the Darwinian selection of the fittest, how it works. Now, in Thailand, in Sri Lanka, all of the mosquitoes who chose to bite monks, they survived because the monks can't kill them. The ones who chose to eat lay people, you spotted most of them. So most of the ones who survived from generation to generation were the ones who drank blood from monks. The more holy, the more safe they were. So that actually gives this evolutionary predisposition to mosquitoes to choose monks to eat for. It's really unfair, but that's true. When a mosquito sees a monk, whoopee, a safe dinner. So yeah, not only that, but those mosquitoes, and the same are all over the world, you know, before they bite you, second person, you can bite me, it's only a tiny bit of blood. They wouldn't just bite you. First of all, they'd buzz around your ears to tell you they were coming. Bzz, 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 I'm going to bite you, bzz, 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 get out of here, bzz, bzz, bzz. They torture you before they bite So, do you know what time is? It's like a mosquito. Bzz, 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 bzz. It's an irritation. And once you get free from time, when time disappears, you understand how wonderful it is to be in the present moment. And how stupid we are to be prisoners of the past and the future. Guilt and anger, that's all about the past. Craving, wanting, and anxiety, that's all about the future. That all vanishes. It's just gone when you're in the present moment. Would you like to be free of your past? Would you like to have no anxiety in the future at all? And come into the present moment. Very free. That's why it's a beautiful layer of patterns. You're kind, you're mindful, and you go into the silence. And then these thoughts, which is really the buzzing mosquitoes, they really irritate. Always have to think about things, work it out, make a decision. I don't know, do you have difficulty making decisions? You think about it, should I, shouldn't I, should I, shouldn't I? But it's very easy to make decisions. There's a very old Western way of making decisions with a Buddhist twist. Last year, was it about last year about this time, I gave a talk in Oslo University. And just at the end of the talk, someone asked me, he said, look, I'm having trouble making an important decision in my life. How do I make decisions in Buddhism? And I said, I said to this girl, I'll never forget this. I said, well, let's make it sort of something more concrete. Suppose the decision is, should I marry my boyfriend or not? At which point she went bright red. She held her hands to her head and turned around to the boyfriend sitting next to her. Be very careful asking questions from monks who can read your mind. She was so embarrassed. So anyway, look. So that's the decision. Should I marry my boyfriend or not? And I said, the way to find a good decision is take a coin and toss a coin. Heads I marry, tails I marry. But with a twist. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. So it comes up heads. How do you feel? What's your reaction? You think, yeah. Then you want to marry him. If it comes up, maybe I'll do 2 out of 3. And then it shows you did want to marry him. So the result of tossing a coin is just to reveal what you want to do. Not to make a decision for you, but to be aware of how you're feeling. If you follow those feelings, you're far more likely to have success than if you follow the thoughts. Those psychology experiments again and again and again, they've given many tests to people that if you have a decision to make and you work it out through logic, through thinking, you compare that to just how you feel, what you should do, the intuition always is more successful than thinking. I mean, one of the reasons we get into trouble in the West, we think too much, we feel too little. Number one, I started to tell you, this thinking which you rely upon just gets you into more trouble. You feel the answer is more reliable. Even when you're doing examinations, if you think about the answer, that can't be right. You do it again, you may make a big mistake. When you feel the answer, right, the first thing which comes down, it's usually correct. So you can see how thinking, what it really is, it's just this mask, this veil which covers the truth. As I said yesterday, you know, when you say, what a beautiful sunset, you're not watching the sunset, you're just watching the label, rather than seeing the thing. So you just go to the silent mind. And in the silent mind, you also realize, because thinking has disappeared, at last you have some peace. And this thinking, which you thought was a friend, which masqueraded as your helper, you find it like a murderer, killing your peace. You understand why people who know inner stillness are the wise ones. People who think are not very clever at all. In our society, we've trained thinkers, which is one of the reasons why we get into big trouble, instead of feelers. People who just know without thinking. So already you had a very beautiful and wonderful layer of petals. But of course there's more to come. You, many of you who have done breath meditation and failed because the breath has come up far too early. You force your attention onto the breath, you just get more stressed out. That is not the way to do anapanasati breath meditation. The best way is using the lotus swimming. Just be kind, be mindful. You come into the present moment, you come into silence. What do? Just be kind. Be mindful of the silence. And because everything is getting still, things begin to disappear. When I was a young Buddhist at university, there weren't that many places I could do any meditations. So I didn't care what tradition it was. Any place which was doing meditation, I'd go there. So once I went to one of these Zen retreats, and we were told to sit facing the wall with your eyes open. I didn't understand it, but you know, when you're young, you're willing to try anything. Just like, you know, very hot burritos, like this guy did last night. You just want to try things, it's just experimenting. So I tried meditation with my eyes open, watching the wall. No one told me what you're supposed to do or why you're supposed to do it, but I was just watching the wall, and after about 10 or 15 minutes, the wall disappeared. It just vanished. That was really weird. But being a student in the 60s, 70s, that was cool. Weird stuff was always very awesome. So I loved weird stuff. But then afterwards I thought, what was going on? How come a wall disappeared? And of course you don't need to have studied biology just to know that your brain is only programmed to notice things which change, which move. When things are still and they don't move, it's like the efficient brain says there's nothing really there to worry about or to be concerned about, and it turns off. In the same way, when you start meditating, you close your eyes, you see the inside of your eyelids at first. After a while, nothing going on there, so the sense of sight turns off. The senses are vanishing. You sit still, nothing is going on. So you can't feel your legs or your hands. No one is saying anything, or there's hardly any noise, even maybe the noise in the background of the traffic. As long as it's a constant noise, you can't hear it after a while. It turns off. As long as people didn't eat baked beans this morning, there were no smells in the room. Remember, if you do eat lots of beans, make sure you don't sit in the front. It's very unkind for all the people sitting behind you. Sit in the back, please, if you've got wind and you're going to fart. So no change. That's why in Buddhist temples they lit lots of incense. So, before the odour does anything to it. So, the sense of smell disappears, taste disappears. And so what's left, which is moving, when everything else becomes still? You're breathing. So quite naturally, when you're just calm and mindful, when you're not doing anything, you'll find that from silence you become aware of your breath, because that's the only thing which is moving. Everything else is vanished. So with the kindness and mindfulness, the next layer of petals you become aware of is your breath. And you don't do this as an act of will. You don't choose to look at your breath. It's just something which happens naturally as you're letting go and things are disappearing more and more. And the great thing about this way of doing breath meditation is when the breath does come, you're so in the present moment, so silent, so relaxed, your breath is naturally very easy to watch. It is actually delightful from the very beginning. If you choose to watch the breath, you have to use force. You're trying to control the meditation, being the driver of your meditation, and you find it's never that peaceful. This is the best way, what I practice when I meditate. I never choose to watch my breath. I'm just kind, in the moment, and waiting for that layer of petals to open up. So you've just got this breath. It's just there. You haven't done anything. You've let go of other things by being kind and being mindful. When you watch this layer of petals, just the breath going in and going out, soon that opens up. You don't go on to the next stage in meditation. This is an important point. You never go on to the next stage. You go in to the next stage. Where you already are, go deeper into it. It's being more fully where you already are, not going somewhere else. Too much in your life, of your life, always been going somewhere else. Never being here. Finishing one test, and then going on to the next exam. And finishing a BA, then having to do an MA, then a PhD, then postgraduate. You always go on to something else. Instead of just being here. So when you're just staying with the breath, mindful and kind, it opens out. The next stage I call the delightful breath, because the deeper you go into the petals, the more fragrant and beautiful they are. It just opens up by itself. It's delightful breath. You're just watching this breath, happy as could be. And you can know it's a delightful breath you're experiencing, because the gong goes for lunch, and you just don't want to get out. Even though you may know you're not going to have any dinner tonight, it's much more enjoyable than having lunch. So I know whether it's a delightful breath or not. If you're just sitting here at lunchtime, you just don't go for lunch. It's no contest. The breath is much more enjoyable. That just gives you an understanding of the delight that is happening. Now, I'm just going to say a few things. That some monks, meditation teachers, make you afraid of the pleasures of meditation. So if you're enjoying yourself, bad meditator. You're going to get attached. You're going to get attached, and that's bad, bad, bad. But that's not how the Buddha taught. This is what is going to happen in meditation. It's what is supposed to happen. in Pali, Pitti Sutra is starting to be developed, the fifth and sixth stages of Amatanasati. As you're breathing, you experience Pitti, you experience Sukha. It's part of what happens. Joy happens, and it's what to expect. And the Buddha said many, many times, such as in Manojiputta Sutta, such as in the Vanavivanga Sutta, so that happiness becomes a meditation. Do not be afraid of it. Develop it, make much of it, follow it. In Pali. It's not to be feared, but to be followed and developed. Because this is an important part of meditation. The joy which comes up in meditation is expected. It is to be embraced, not to be got rid of. And in the Pasarika Sutta, this is the Digha Nikaya. This is where I quote, the Buddha was telling one of his monks, Kumara Kassapa, if any of the people ask you, you monks are just attached to the pleasure of meditation, please tell those people, yes, we are. And he said, also tell them, there are four consequences, only four, not five, of being attached to the pleasure of meditation. The word attachment is anuyoga here. Anuyoga literally means being yoked along with, using the simile of two cows or two horses being tied together pulling a chariot. If you're attached to those pleasures of meditation, you can only expect one of four things. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or putting on it. That's in the Pasarika Sutta. That's what's supposed to happen. It leads to enlightenment. So if you try and abandon that pleasure, you are stopping yourself becoming so once enlightened. So please do not abandon that pleasure. Follow it. It's not to be feared. So this is where you experience. You can start to get happy when you're meditating. And it's a wonderful thing when people start to experience a delightful breath and sit for hours after hours without any effort. Because when they go out afterwards, they realize what meditation is all about. It's just joyful. When you're having so much happiness and pleasure, with no bad side effects, not only are you healthier physically, you tend to be more resilient to what Hamlet said, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and what happens to you in life. You're not so, don't get angry. How can you get angry when you're having such a good time? It solves a lot of problems, just delightful breath. And also it makes you addicted to meditation, like I am. I'm a meditation junkie. And you're supposed to be doing that. That's what is expected of you. Which means you come to meditation, not because something you have to do, but something you love doing. As the Buddha said, the mind leaps to it. It says, wow, meditation, yes, I want to come. Because you're enjoying it. It's this beautiful, delightful layer of petals called the delightful breath. Now remember, by this time, there's no effort required. Some people ask me, what is like effort then, in the Eightfold Path? It's the effort to stop controlling things, to go against the stream, the effort to say no, the effort to renounce, the effort to be kind, to be mindful, which is basically no effort at all. Just be. To stop. Now once you get to the light of breath, because it's hardly any effort, the mind becomes even more still. So much so that there's hardly any difference between the in-breath and the out-breath. It's just breath, that's all. And because there's hardly any difference, because nothing is changing, what happens next? The breath disappears. Bye-bye, breath. And that's the last part of your five senses have disappeared. You can't see, hear, smell, taste, and bodily touch. It's gone. Another layer of petals has opened up. You're going deep inside, finding out exactly what is this jewel in the heart of the lotus, which is you. When this happens, we get to the level of meditation called the nimittas. These are the way we experience the mind, the citta. This is 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th stage of Anapanasati, if you read the Anapanasati Sutta, taught by the Buddha. What happens to me, you start to see this beautiful light in the mind. It was so surprising, so wonderful, very exciting. When it first comes out, you think, wow. And as soon as you say something like, wow, the whole thing disappears. Have this beautiful still mind, and don't interfere with it. Leave it alone. Your job is just to be mindful and to be kind. That's all. Kindness relaxes things, it makes things still. Sometimes when I talk to you, I talk in a very soft voice, so relax. But if I say, step up, be quick, come up. You see how tense you get when you're angry? But when you're very calm and soft, everything relaxes and starts to disappear. This is what happens. The breath vanishes. Your five senses in your body have gone. All you've got left is the sixth sense, which is the mind. It appears as a beautiful light. If you haven't experienced a nimitta while you've been meditating, this beautiful light in the mind, you will. Everyone will experience a nimitta. Even Catholics, Muslims, non-believers of anything, they all experience a nimitta when they die. You all know the near-death experiences, leaving the body, going towards the light. That is the same as an image you experience in meditation. Why? In meditation your five senses have stopped. In death, they've stopped totally. You let go of the body. You've died. Even just seeing this nimitta in deep meditation and getting to know it, one of the results of that, the most of experience of nimitta, is you know when you die, your mind will carry on. Your five senses have disappeared. You've got the idea of what the citta is. You understand what the mind is. Just going back to the tadpole simile, how can a tadpole know what water is? But it's different what it's like in water. Even though it becomes a water scientist and does experiments on water in the lab inside the lake, still it's in the lake. When the body vanishes and the five senses are gone, you understand what this body really is. What seeing and hearing, smelling, tasting truly are and touching. You just cannot know that until they vanish. All the insight that people have about sensory experience and having a body, you haven't gone deep enough yet, you just don't know. No more than a fish can understand what water is. It vanishes, you've got this beautiful mind. You understand what the mind is, what the body is, how separate they are. It's very obvious to you that rebirth is a fact. So what happens next? This beautiful layer, incredibly beautiful layer of Paris, with this nimitta, it just gets brighter and more faint. This is when you get to the juicy stuff of meditation. It's so common when I teach like this, people when they experience it, but remember, stop craving for the nimittas. So yeah, I've got the nimittas now, I shall go up, so it's good. Look, you're wanting, you never get it that way. If you want nimittas, just remember, stop wanting, just be mindful, be kind, that's all you do. Any wanting stops the process happening. So stop craving these attainments. Just put the causes in place and they'll come by themselves. So these images become so beautiful, so wonderful. Many of my students, one reason I just taught a retreat just before I came here, they said it was just so wonderful, I didn't think I could take anymore. And I remember the time when I was just so blissed out and thought, no human being can take so much ecstasy. Now this was, you know, I'd experienced many things in my life, including really good sex. And this was way, way in a bit differently. Much, much more bliss. Longer lasting. And it got to such an extreme, I thought, I can't take any more bliss. It's impossible, I'm going to explode. Martin and I have a very deep insight, which I'd love to share with you. You can always take more bliss. Just go for it. It is the power of the mind. And it gets very, very strong. Incredibly beautiful petals. That nematode just opens up. Just like the fourth inside the nematode is just embracing it. And it disappears. And inside you go into the world of the giants. Incredible, beautiful worlds of deep stillness. Where you can't feel the body anymore. That's when somebody rings a bell. You just can't hear them. One of the extreme forms of the jhana, one of the very deep jhanas, which just an ordinary Australian guy got in front. And I've talked about this in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. He was just one of these meditators, you know, who maybe do half an hour here, half an hour there. On a Sunday afternoon, you know, there's nothing on TV. So he told his wife, I'm going to my bedroom to meditate. So he did his bedroom maybe an hour and a half, and that's when his wife came in to check on him. He hadn't come out yet. So when she went into his room, she saw him meditating perfectly still. Too still. She couldn't see him breathing. She went up close. His abdomen wasn't moving at all. He'd stopped breathing. So she rang in Australia, 000. Is it 999 in Canada? 911. 911, it's good to know that, so some of you have to know. Rang 911. And this was close to the hospital, so the ambulance came in 5 minutes. And they rushed into his room, he was a trained medic, looked at him, couldn't see any breath, checked his pulse, there was no pulse. Put him straight into the gurney, into the back of the ambulance, going through all the red lights, rushing to the emergency room, the local hospital, as fast as they could. Putting him into the emergency room. You know, you've seen the movies. Actually, I've never seen this. I'm just making it up what I think would happen. And they put on defibrillators. No, they put on some ECG, first of all. Give me a second one there. But I don't watch the TV. Give me a break. Put on ECG, first of all. And ECG, flatline, ding, 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 emergency. I was really disappointed to find out from a doctor who does work in the emergency room, the ECG never goes ding, ding, ding. What do they do in Canada? Alarm?
Beep.
No, because there was no, it's a flat line.
Yes, a beep.
Beep. Okay, thank you. Now I know how to tell the story again. It was a flat line, no heartbeat. They put an EEG, another flat line, no brain activity, just animal. The guy was dead. They were very lucky that the doctor on duty that evening, or that afternoon, Sunday afternoon, was from India. Because he heard that through meditation, you can suspend all your life activities. And heard from the wife, he'd been meditating. So I decided to give him a chance. Because if he'd have sent him down the mall, which an Australian doctor would have done, when he came out of meditation, he did later on, the walk attendants would have probably died of shock. He was just meditating, that's all. So they put defibrillators on his body. You know, that's the electric shocks. Boom! To try and get his heart going. Nothing worked. So the doctor kept on trying. He heard this from his wife. His wife said, look, we're trying to revive you for half an hour, 45 minutes. But then he decided to come out of his meditation. Opened his eyes, bent up. Hey, I was in my room. What am I doing in here? Beep. Beep. The ECG and the EEG were perfect. And the doctor gave him a thorough examination, nothing wrong with him. He didn't even admit him overnight. He went home with his wife. He walked home perfectly okay. That's a true story. He said the only unpleasant part of that, while he was in a deep meditation, it's more bliss than he ever felt in his whole life. Incredible stillness and bliss. The only bad result of that was the scolding he got from his wife. Don't you ever do that again.
I thought you were dead.
Now that's, I'm not telling that story because that shows what it's like to be in the jhanas. You can't hear the sound of the siren of the ambulance. You can't even feel defibrillators jerking your body. You can't see, feel anything. You're within the realm of the mind. Everything else is vanished. So blessed. So now you understand what this body actually is, what this mind is. But that's only the first level of jhanas. The lotus is opening up. The first jhana is just so still and so peaceful, so joyful, because the body has disappeared. And those people who want to know what suffering is. Somebody told me yesterday, they've got a friend who's having a very successful life. What do you mean about suffering? All these Buddhists talk about suffering. I'm happy. You Buddhists, you should get a life. Well, like some people in Singapore when they're choosing religions. Choosing Christianity is much better. So in Christianity, you can drink, you can party at Christmas. Buddhists are not allowed to do that. You can't drink alcohol. At least you're not supposed to. But they say, no, there's no suffering. I say, just like the person born in prison, lived all their life in prison, thinks prison is fun, because they know nothing else. If you've let go of your body once and experienced a jhana, you understand why this body is suffering. Even if you're rich, healthy, and having a good time, you just don't know what it's like outside the prison of your body. But now it starts to get even more interesting. Because when you get into the second jhana, it's like the first jhana, it's incredibly beautiful petals. You think you can't have any more happiness in this. It opens up. And you go inside to the next level, which is the second jhana. Something else is missing in the second jhana. Something again, which has always been there. So much so, you can't understand it. And I mentioned this because I was talking about this a little bit in the refectory before I came up. This is your will. Choosing. The thing which you take to be under your control. The essential part of who you think you are. The one who chooses and does things. Do you really understand what the will is? Of course you don't. It has to disappear first of all. And then you understand, oh, now that's what the world was. It's very easy to read Buddhist scriptures and say that this does not belong to me, this is not mine. Even in the Anathapana Sutta, the second sutta teaching of the Buddha, he said, Sankhara, it doesn't belong to me. Sankhara, the fourth of the khandhas, includes the will. The will is the most prominent part of that khandha, part of the mental world. So the will doesn't belong to you. You can't control it. Nothing to do with you. It's not me, not mine, not yourself. We all think it's yours until it disappears. When it vanishes, you realize it didn't belong to you after all. This will which controls your life, which makes choices, vanishes. That's why in that second jhana you're perfectly still. No movement at all. It's the perfection of samadhi and stillness. And it's the happiness of bliss, of absolute stillness where nothing moves, where you can't move. You can't do anything. You disappear. No will left. Wow. That's blissful. When I say that, it may scare you to bits. But remember, if you really are committed to finding out the truth, you have to be courageous. To let go of your most cherished ideas. Never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Everything you ever thought about, everything you ever imagined what the world was, now is seen to be just so worthless. Once it's gone, once water is gone, then the frog can understand what water is. You understand what wood is. Nothing to do with you. Which is why you let go more and more. A person who understands never becomes a control freak. Control freak is a strengthening your will, making it wiser, sharper, more clever. That's not the way of Buddhism. The way of Buddhism is letting go of the will. Letting go. Being free. Not controlling. Loving is not controlling. Compassion is accepting people as they are. Not trying to make them different. Accepting yourself as you are. Not using your will to make you into a wiser, better person. We really go around spirituality in the right way. We come to temples like this to try and train ourselves to be better people, to control ourselves. Once you understand what Buddhism is, you understand just what a myth that is. You don't make yourself a better person by controlling. You become a better person by letting go of control. By kindness. By peace. So what do you see when you understand what the Buddha is? It vanishes. I don't know what it is. You know there's still more stuff to come. That lotus is going through very beautiful petals. There's more to come. As you go through those garments, the next thing which disappears is your mind. You lose your mind. Sometimes we call that in the West, if you lose your mind, you're crazy. That's not losing your mind. To really lose your mind, but even that vanishes. Consciousness disappears slowly. That's in the immaterial states. To the place of your well of nothing. To the place where there's neither perception or non-perception. You can't say one thing aware or you're not aware. It's going and it goes. The end of the mind. It vanishes. Isn't that wonderful? You're not here. There's no one to do anything. So sometimes people ask me, well, what is a jewel in the heart of the lotus? If I told you, you wouldn't believe me. There's nothing there. It's emptiness. The trouble is, people want to give nothing a name. I love quoting from Alice in Wonderland. When Alice arrived at the home of the Red Queen asked Alice, oh, when you were coming here, I was waiting for my messenger. Did you pass anyone on the road? And he said, I passed no one on the road. No, did you see anyone on the road? No, I saw no one on the road. You saw no one? You must have very good eyes. It's hard enough for me to see someone, but you see no one. And then when the messenger did arrive, did you see anyone on the road? No, I saw no one. Actually, the girl saw that same person. She saw no one too. And did anyone pass you on the road? No one passed me on the road, said the messenger. Well, you must have been walking very slowly if that person passed you. And that's actually quite true, because no one got here before you. So that is a wonderful... That great author is just making something out of no one. A person. And that's the problem with people. When actually everything vanishes, we try to make something out of nothing. There's no one there. Empty, gone. So that's where this meditation is going to take you. All the way to the experience of emptiness. Not to the thought of emptiness. I know that some people think insight meditation means seeing rise and fall. That's just like seeing the waves on the lake go up and down, up and down. Anyone can see that. That's not enlightenment. Enlightenment is watching that lake, seeing the waves get less and less and less, until the lake is perfectly still. And not stopping there, just staying with kindness and mindfulness, and then seeing the whole lake vanish. Lakes are not supposed to do that. The mountains surrounding that lake and the sky above also vanishes. It's all gone. That is insight. That is that nature. the deep stuff. All coming from just being aware and being kind. Your own just opens up to the very end. And I'm going to finish, before I open up for a few Q&A, with one of the great instructions from my master Ajahn Chah. When he was getting sick, he would visit our monastery every week for a sauna. This was in 1983-82. And he would always give us a talk, and then we would go and help him with his sauna. That was in Asia, that's looking after your master, looking after your teacher, doing anything for him. So that day he gave a very good talk on meditation. You know, after you give a really good talk, you get inspired. When you get inspired, it's just so easy to meditate. So there's many other people helping my teacher. So I went down the back of the hall just to meditate. I only thought for 5 or 10 minutes, but I went really deep. And when I came out of meditation, I didn't know what time it was. But my first thought was to try and see if I can still do some service for my teacher. So I got up and started walking towards the sauna. And I realized I was too late, so I saw that Ajahn Chah coming in the opposite direction. It was only a narrow path, we were going to pass. And that's when he looked at me, it's just before we were going to pass. He looked at me really powerfully. Because now these monks, when they do have powers, they don't usually show them, they don't show off. He was looking right inside my mind. And for once, I didn't mind. A lot of the time, I'd be embarrassed to let him see my mind. That's why I don't read your minds, because it would be very embarrassing. That's invasion of privacy, so we don't do that. So my mind was so peaceful and so pure after coming out of a deep meditation. He looked at me and tried to make me a monk there on the spot. He looked at me and said, "Brahma Mansa, why?" He asked me the great question, why? Now you may think about that and you just get into verbal knots. This is not the sort of question you can answer through thought. You have to be very still and just see. So my answer was, I don't know. I was so stupid, I didn't know what the answer was. Just because I had a good meditation, I was still working on it. And good teachers never scold you. But he thought it was very funny and just laughed his head off. We stupid disciples caused the teacher so much merriment. Stupid things we did, they always think it's so funny. But then he stopped laughing. He looked at me and said, "I'm going to tell you the answer. The answer to the question why." This is coming from one of the greatest meditation masters in Thailand, Ajahn Chah. Do you want to know the answer? He said, "The answer to the question why is, there's nothing. It's nothing." He looked at me again and said, "Do you understand?" I said, "Yes." He said, "No, you don't." And he walked away. So do you understand? No, of course you don't. But nevertheless, I'll tell you the answer. To make it very clear that this is the path to enlightenment. Seeing what's inside of you. Through stillness, the lotus opens up. A path of bliss, profundity, going to places you never dreamed were possible. Experiences which are totally out of this world. You, lay person, old, young, whoever you are, you sit there and it just happens. Some of the most unlikely people have done this and get deep in meditation. Why not you? I'll tell you why not. Because you don't follow the instructions. Instead of just sitting here being kind and being mindful, you want to do something. Okay, I'm being kind and being mindful. Why is nothing happening? That's wanting. So just be kind, be mindful. Such simple instructions, but so hard to do. That's all you need to do. So, That's the talk and meditation for this morning. Any questions?
Yes, we've got the microphone, the roving one.
Just preparation. But if you try and watch the breath, you're trying. In meditation, it's not the object of meditation which is important. It's the attitude you have to meditation is important. What you're doing with what you're experiencing. That is the heart of meditation. These experiences you have of breath or beautiful breath, these are just what happens when you let go, when you have the right attitude. So don't go thinking, I'm on this stage or on that stage. Please never think like that. Just, are you being kind? Are you being mindful? Or are you doing something else? This is what happens. Look, sometimes people come to me and I teach them breath meditation at the beginning. And if they can't do breath meditation, and they say, this is too difficult, then I teach them Anapanasati. If they can't do Anapanasati, then I teach them loving kindness meditation. When they can't do that, then I teach them metta. If they can't do metta meditation, I teach them vipassana. If they find vipassana difficult, then I teach them insight. If they can't do insight meditation, then I teach them breath meditation. By that time, they forgot that's when they started. It's all exactly the same. It's just letting go, going against the stream of craving. That's the only type of meditation there is. So all this idea, scanning the body, metta meditation, kasina meditation, vipassana meditation, blah, 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 that is a myth. It's just meditation, that's all. Letting go, letting go inside.
Thank you.
There you go. A question over here. So you can do all those types of meditation if you like, but just make sure you do them with mindfulness and letting go. All kinds.
Thank you, Mati. I forgot my question.
You let go.
I really appreciate what you're saying. I want to know if we need a reading book about my Shinran, something I can't do. That you go, you just have to think, okay, you have to stay 5 minutes and calm down. I just the slow and calm down. So you don't really need to. Do you master jhana?
Who's mastering what?
That's right.
So in other words, it's not controlling these things, it's not owning them, it's not making these like some spiritual attainment that you can wear on your chest, like in the army, you know, one stripe for streamliner, two stripes for white returner, three for non-returner, and the pips on your shoulders for arahat. But we don't do those sorts of things. It's to see how much you can disappear. That's why that latest book which I wrote from my talk, which were basically for monks, but you know, people gave it out to anybody. So it was called The Art of Disappearing. In part of that's viraga. Disappearing, vanishing. Very good. So now you can get lost. Okay, here you go.
Yeah, I had an experience meditating where I would start falling like very fast. It would feel like that.
Yeah.
And but it wasn't pleasant. It was like, and I would have to wake myself up, or I don't know, I'd shot in and I would do that. So that's how I meditated.
No, that ever happens again. Enjoy it. You're just adding fear to the experience. So just be kind, be mindful. And you find the experiences vanish.
Yeah.
The experience is pretty neutral. But it's what we act to it is causing the problem.
What's causing the problem?
It's what we add to the experience causes the negativity. The disturbing part of the experience is as you're falling, you're having to abandon something you're not ready to abandon yet.
And well, I just don't want another experience of the guy that went to the hospital kind of like,
oh, you ask that guy. He said the most wonderful experience of his life. Had a great time. No, don't be afraid, you can't die. Look, even in the sutras, it told the story of this guy. He was meditating in the forest in the time of the Buddha, and his two villagers saw him, and he wasn't breathing or anything. They thought he was dead. So they thought, no, we're Buddhists, this is a good monk. We just can't leave to get eaten by the jungle animals, so we'll do a cremation. So they got some wood out, which was there in the forest. Didn't take them too long to get a pile of wood, put the monk on top, lit it. Once the fire was established, they had business to do. You know, you can't hang around cremating monks all day. So off they went up, doing whatever. You can imagine what they felt in the morning when the monk came on arms round. Not even his robes were burnt. Such was the story of the sutras. There's a monk I know. He was an Indonesian monk many years ago. He told me his story before he became a monk. This was in Java, maybe in the early 70s. He went off into the jungle, and he said he saw this incredibly beautiful light come towards him, and he just got lost in the light for many days. When he came out of meditation, he noticed where he was sitting was different. It was a sign of a flood. He checked with the local villagers, and yes, he'd been immersed in water for many days. Totally underneath the water. I know that monk, he's not saying no lie. He has very powerful meditation powers. It's actually happened. So if that happens, you are perfectly safe. Money back guarantee, sir. Don't you want to have interesting experiences? Sometimes we're too scared. We like living in our comfort zone, where we understand everything. You're going into places. Amazing, wonderful places. And I can guarantee you're totally safe. In fact, you come out much better than ever before. The only danger is one danger. I should be honest with you. One day, if you have too many of those experiences, you end up losing your hair. Okay.
You mentioned this really importance of having a smile on your face when you start your meditation. As you
yes.
Have you ever had the experience of seeing the light when you had started your meditation with a smile on your face?
Sometimes, I'm not sure because I'm not aware of my body when I meditate, but sometimes people say that, oh, you're smiling even when you meditate. Becomes unconscious. It's because when you're happy, just the body reacts by smiling. Quite natural. So it doesn't matter where you start. You can start with a bit of misery, but you just go inside of it and you get happier and happier and happier as you go. That's right, yeah, but inside you're always happy. The path to deep meditation is always through happiness. And even enlightenment is through happiness too. So this path is not a path of misery and endurance. Somehow or other, because I think it's a Western tradition of Christianity was very ascetic. I remember as a kid going to church, and it was always grey stone, hard pews, no upholstery, and the priest was always telling you what a bad sinner you were. No laughter, no jokes. It was just so cold, so harsh. And yeah, that never really turned me on at all. And somehow you understood that if this was real enlightenment, it had to be a path of peace, of happiness, of freedom. All those amazing ideas. Now surely that must be what religion's all about. So I could never ever trust, from that time on, a miserable teacher. If I saw any teacher who couldn't laugh, couldn't smile, couldn't relax, no way could they know really what they were talking about. So it is a path of happiness, from bliss upon bliss upon bliss. And what the other gentleman said, that's scary. It is scary to have so much bliss which you cannot control. It's not being able to control it, it's scary bit. Yeah.
Thank you.
question about meditation. I know you practice makes you perfect. If I am a beginner at meditation and if I spend like half an hour a day, in your experience, how long will it take to focus?
Okay. If you walk to LA half an hour a day, how long do you spend eating? Or even better, how long do you spend cooking every day?
Maybe 1 hour.
That's all eating.
For a day?
Yeah.
Oh, more than that. Maybe about 1.5 to 2 hours eating. A lot.
Well, you should spend the same time meditating. A rule of thumb: however long you spend eating, spend the same number of minutes or hours meditating. Because meditation is food for your heart. If you say you can't find the time to meditate, cut back on the time eating, spend a minute on it.
Thanks for coming. I just have one question. You were explaining about your food poisoning.
Yeah.
You said you will be kind and mindful of your body and do it away. I'm just curious how that works and what I mean, you just sit there?
I really don't know. I just sat there. Just not any great posture. I think lying on the floor. And just maybe in fetal position or something, which you usually go to when you're suffering. And just no round about the body, just focusing on the pain.
You just focus on the pain and
be compassionate towards it. And straight away, I learned that many of you haven't got a clue what compassion is. You think you do, that's the problem. You think, I know what compassion is, being kind. But this is where you really find out if you know what you're talking about. If it really is compassion, it softens things, it frees things. That's why we're silent. So if you can be compassionate to the pain, it will always get less. So when it gets less, what I just did was real compassion. So you learn what compassion and kindness truly is. And also you learn how to relax his body so much. Any place you have a pain, you can just relax it. Even deepest places inside. Now you all have heard many cases of things like tumors just shrinking and disappearing. People who meditate, so many experiences people who have meditated, those things have happened. For example, one of those experiences of many which come up. I was teaching a retreat in Sydney. And during the retreat, I got many complaints because one of the meditators was making a noise. Every time he meditated, he was breathing in very loudly. And that was driving the other meditators crazy. So they said, can you please ask people to breathe quietly? And so I said, that man has got a big tumor in his nose, nasal cancer, or sinus cancer, whatever it's called. He said he can't breathe through his nose. He hasn't been able to do that for weeks because of this big tumour. It's the only way he can breathe. But as soon as I said that, people stopped complaining and gave him compassion. Because this guy, it was his last strong advice before he died. He'd never done meditation before, so when he told me, I thought, we've left it too late. But on the very last day before I left the retreat centre, he came to me and said he was meditating on the last day. And he suddenly, this is how he described it, he heard this pop in his nose. He could breathe through his nose for the first time in weeks. And then it sort of closed up again and could breathe through his nose. It only lasted about 2 or 3 minutes. He'd experienced a tumour shrinking. Could he actually breathe? But I really thought it was too late for the guy. He left it sort of too late. So he left. About 3 or 4 years later, I was teaching. I gave him a talk in Sydney. This guy came up to me afterwards and said, do you remember me? Please never say that to a monk. I see so many people. You know just how many places I go to and how many people I see. So I said, no, I've got a clue. I'm honest. So I am honest, so I might disappoint you. I don't know who you are. But I said, you died the last time. You came to my house. Yeah, but there's been many 365 times 4 meals since I last saw you. But anyhow, he said it was that guy. He said, after that meditation, I learned how to shrink my tumor. It's totally gone. Full remission. Now I'm spending the rest of my life teaching your meditation method. So I've seen that so many times. You have to be kind to relax enough to allow these things to vanish. It does work, it doesn't always work, but it works in many cases. Yeah?
Hi, I wanted to know, you talked about letting go of the past and detaching yourself from it, but what happens when you're struggling with that while people in your life are trying to continuously enforce that on you? How do you balance that?
Well, when people are trying to force it on you, you don't have to accept it. When people talk to you, that's why you have two ears. One's to go in, one's to go out. Think that I don't want to keep, I then go out straight away. Don't have people control you. You have independence. They may try and blame you for the past, or criticize you for the past, but who knows who did what? Our memory is so uncertain of who did what. It's very common that policemen who take witness statements after a crime, they're amazed. It's only about half an hour ago and the person who swore they saw two cars when there was only one. We make up our memory on the spot. What actually happened is maybe 50%, and the rest of the 50% is what we add on to our memory. You just cannot rely on the memory of the past. Because of that, it's a waste of time just dealing with the past and holding it and keeping it. We don't really know what happened. So just let it all go.
Yeah.
Okay. So don't let other people control you. They don't want to make you say, oh no, sorry, I'm a Buddhist, I don't do the past. They might think you're crazy, but that's their fault. You're happy.
But when you first switch jhana, is there a risk that you might get attached to those jhanas?
There is, but that's what you're supposed to do. If you're attached to the jhanas, it's four results. Steaming, watch returning, non-returning, arahat. Would you like one of those four? Or be attached to the jhanas? It's not attachment to the jhanas that's the problem. It's attachment to all the other things. That's what the problem is. Not the jhanas. Jhanas are stages of letting go. You know that when you experience these things, you think, what are you talking about attachment to this stuff? This is not the sort of stuff which is low and mean, which is going to keep you in samsara, keep you getting reborn. This is the way out. So anyone who starts to say, oh, these are bad states, means they never experienced them. If you experience those states, you know that this is the path to Nirvana. It's the eighth factor, the eightfold path. It's how the Buddha became a Buddha, going through the jhanas and the Bodhi tree. From that time on, the Buddha said, do not be afraid of those attainments, those jhanas. And any monk who comes along who says, you'll be attached to those jhanas, don't do them. That monk is making a very bad karma. I'm saying that, you know, seriously, because they're stopping people becoming enlightened. If you want to check that out, look at Parsadika Sutta, Nigan Nikaya. The Buddha writes it, the word of the Buddha. It's very, very clear.
Yes?
When you were describing nimittas and jhanas,
yes,
they appear to be very blissful states, so it kind of generates a motivation just to experience this type of state.
Exactly, we call it marketing.
Now, after when you describe the emptiness, when everything disappears, does it mean that the joy disappears too? It's kind of disappointing that the end is kind of, you know, the path is very blissful, but the end is emptiness, and emptiness in my mind is but nothing and no joy too.
It's not that joy, man. It's not understanding what emptiness is. This is the problem, why you have to experience these things. I'm telling you how to experience, not just to believe them. As you get closer and closer, you start to realize the bliss of emptiness.
So there is bliss in it.
Absolutely, but a different type of bliss than you never imagined before. This is one of the things that you're really experiencing, what pleasure really is. You guys just living in the world don't know what pleasure is. This is why the nuts, I'm addicted to the beautiful pleasures of life. Sometimes people, you're a monk, you shouldn't have any fun at all. What do you mean? If I didn't have any fun, what's the point of being a monk? I just know a much higher pleasure than you guys know. I'm saying, come and join me. The pleasure of bliss upon bliss upon bliss. And all these different pleasures which get more and more refined. Great example, when I was young, I used to really get off on Jimi Hendrix. He was my favourite, my idol, and I went to go see him many times. But it was very noisy music. And as I got sort of more refined, I started to like classical music, which was much more refined pleasure than no rock. And as I became more refined, I preferred the sound of the wind in the trees, and even classical music. As I became more refined, I enjoyed silence above all other types of music. You get more and more refined until you enjoy emptiness more than anything else. You're learning the pleasure of the night. And this is actually what one description of what the Buddha said is delusion. It's people who just don't know what is happiness. They think is suffering. What is suffering, they think is happiness. Sometimes people think, being a mother, being a nun, this must be so hard. You can't do this, you can't do that. That's why we call monastic women, we call them nuns. Now we call them nuns. None of this, none of that. Tell me, I do apologize. But as you develop, you understand what happiness is. It's the only reason why I stay as a monk, because I'm having a good time. I didn't become a monk because I was hopeless in the world. I was very successful. I became a monk for the higher happiness. Happiness upon happiness upon happiness. You stay as a monk, you're having a great time. Thank you. He was like, monks, you can't have any. Oh, what's my father's old joke? My father, who had no idea of religion, his old joke was, what fun does a monk have? What fun does a monk have? And the answer is, none. That's not true. Okay, it took you a while to get that. Okay, so let's do some meditation. It's only 20 minutes, so it's Mickey Mouse meditation before lunch, but we can do so. So if you haven't already stood up, and just